You know, we used to live in a world where teenagers would say dumb things and get themselves in proportional trouble. Maybe you would get suspended. Maybe you'd be clapping erasers. Maybe you'd have to write a paper. You'd learn a lesson. Now everything young people say is recorded, or it's in text or Snap or TikTok or whatever. And it just exists out there to be rediscovered, to resurface at an inopportune and embarrassing moment. And I think that allows us to hold young people to a standard that they have never been held to in previous history, that is just most people cannot clear it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. My guest today is Robbie Suave, senior editor at Reason Magazine and author of the book Panic Attack, Young Radicals in the Age of Trump. Robbie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk with you.
So I wanted to talk to you about something that I'm sure our listeners have heard of before. It's become kind of a cultural phenomenon and political football over the last year or two, I would say, but that's cancel culture. You've been one of the people reporting on these stories, right, where some person gets fired for old tweets or gets canceled over something they do or say. You've been at this, I think, since before most people were focused on it, but it's become, I would say, in recent months, kind of a muddled issue where the term has become so overused, it's starting to lose any meaning. So I guess just to get us going, what is cancel culture? How do you define it?
Sure. It's an enormously broad topic. Obviously, a lot of things get called cancel culture that debatably aren't, but then you can call anything you want cancel culture because there's no dictionary definition of it. So I think of cancel culture as this new system we live in where people are punished, often informally, but sometimes formally, for past things they've said or done that are maybe bad, but they are punished vastly disproportionately to the sin they committed. In many cases, the sin being something from their adolescence, something more than 10 years old, expressed on social media. So there are various aspects of cancel culture, the pile-on on Twitter, the maybe even death threats and harassment on phone calls, etc. Maybe your boss fires you. Maybe you can no longer go to the college you want to get into. Not every one of these has all of these aspects. Some of them are more justified than others, but these are like the thing. I've been thinking about coming up with like a cancel culture checklist or quiz. Like, you get 5 points if it was this long ago and another 5 points if it's this, but you have to subtract 4 points if you're a public figure and there should be more accountability for the things you said, something like that.
So I guess that brings up a question. A lot of people say, cancel culture doesn't exist. It's just private accountability or people just being held responsible for their words. Obviously, cancel culture is not government censorship, but it is a cultural phenomenon that punishes people with societal consequences for old wrong think or words. And where do you draw the line, I guess, then, between cancel culture as it is properly understood as unfair attacks versus boycotts or responsibility or accountability?
Right. And it's very important to draw that distinction as a libertarian. So I'm not calling for a government solution to this problem. There isn't one. I'm not saying people don't have the right to hold others accountable for stupid things they said on Twitter 15 years ago. I just kind of think it's bad. And I'm allowed to just say things are bad. And wouldn't it be great if we didn't do that? And I think most people are broadly sympathetic to that because a lot of the most egregious cases are really awful. You know, we used to live in a world where teenagers would say dumb things and get themselves in proportional trouble. Maybe you would get suspended. Maybe you'd be clapping erasers. Maybe you'd have to write a paper. You'd learn a lesson about why whatever your cruel bullying thing was wrong. And then it's forgotten. It doesn't stick around forever. You go on to become a well-adjusted adult. You get a job, etc. That's how it was when I was in high school. I'm not quite sure how old you are, but it was probably changing when you were in high school because smartphones.
Oh yeah, there's everywhere. Everyone had Instagram and Twitter.
Now everything young people say is recorded, or it's in text, or Snap, or TikTok, or whatever, and it just exists out there to be rediscovered, to resurface at an inopportune and embarrassing moment. And I think that allows us to hold young people to a standard that they have never been held to in previous history, that is just most people cannot clear it.
So maybe to help us clarify exactly what we're talking about when we talk about cancel culture, because now people have started calling everything they don't like cancel culture. They've started saying, you're criticizing me, the cancel culture. But can you give us maybe one example that you think clear as day, this is example of cancel culture?
Absolutely. So the recent, the Teen Vogue incident is clearly, it's textbook cancel culture to me. So Alexi McCammond was the incoming editor of Teen Vogue. She's a young woman of color. I think she's 27 now. And she was a White House correspondent, political reporter previous to this. She's going to be the new editor of Teen Vogue. And she has these kind of nasty tweets about Asian Americans. I think there might have been a homophobic one from 10 years ago, from when she was in high school, that have come up before and she has apologized for. And like, she is a progressive person. I don't believe that she's racist. I don't even really believe that she was racist 10 years ago. She was probably just saying nasty stuff because that's what teenagers do. But she has certainly apologized. I think it's just purely bad faith, right, to say that she is racist against Asian Americans. I don't believe that. And I don't think any charitable person would actually believe that. But now she gets this job, probably a dream job for her. And the staff, some staff members, some very woke progressive staff members of Teen Vogue bring these tweets up again. You know, they put out a statement decrying this, and ultimately she's forced to resign from this job even before she takes it. And now she's branded, you know, a racist again. And then the additional wrinkle, which often happens in these cases, one of the staffers who was leading the charge, well, you can look up their old tweets. And of course they said things 10 years ago when they were younger that were offensive because everyone, not because she's bad or Alexi's bad, but because all teenagers, virtually all of them are bad. And now that we have a record of it, it's really should prompt us to reevaluate these norms.
Well, I guess that's the biggest problem I have with cancel culture is you mentioned proportionality, but I also think of it in some sense as in terms of growth or moving on from things in the sense that like, say that she did. I think she did have some homophobic tweets from when she was a teenager, whatever. Well, one, there's the proportionality of it. Me as a gay person, right? The amount of harm that I experience her having tweeted an anti-gay slur 10 years ago, pretty minimal. Even gay people that knew her or followed her, in the grand scheme of things, pretty minimal. When weighed against losing a job, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and having your whole reputation tarred. So it's totally disproportionate, one. And two, and this is the more concerning thing, a lot of people, almost everyone, I would wager, actually, has said and done stupid things as a teenager that didn't age well if someone dug up a record. But if you're going to be doomed forever, like 10 years later, 20 years later, based on this one thing, why should anyone grow or evolve?
Right, or why should anyone ever apologize, right? The ideal in these situations would be, yeah, I'm very sorry for that. That doesn't reflect who I am. I am embarrassed of some things I did in past years or when I was younger. That's something most people would have occasion to say regarding something from their past. And you can learn from that and move on and be forgiven. But there's no forgiveness with cancel culture, or there's very little of it. There are very few cases where the person just, you know, does the apology, but doesn't then get marched off, you know, to the
sometimes they
gallows.
Do. If they're woke enough and relevant enough, if you're Joy Reid, then the apology, half apology is just fine. The MSNBC anchor who had all this homophobic blogging, right? There are a few select cases where the apology is enough.
Yeah, it is very weird that she got away with it. And also what she said. And again, I think she should have been forgiven for what she did.
Well, only if she actually apologized and took accountability, which she never did. She gaslit.
She claimed, right, that she was hacked, which is ridiculous and a lie and speaks to her credibility as a journalist. So that actually, to me, became the more disturbing or more criticize-worthy part of that. Because, and also, she is a figure who should be held to greater public account. So it does matter. So I've said that cancel culture, you know, people finding that Marjorie Taylor Greene was supportive of QAnon in the not so distant past and criticizing her for it and saying she should not be a political figure, political representative because of it, that is not cancel culture. Political figures are supposed to be held accountable for the views they express on policy and news topics by the citizenry that elects them. So that is so you lose like 100 points in the cancel culture checklist if you're literally an elected member of the government who is supposed to reflect the views of like right-thinking constituents. So that is not an example of cancel culture to me. Now, if they had found some time when Marjorie Taylor Greene was 15 and she'd said on the, you know, the message boards from the 90s, I'm not sure quite how old she is either, something offensive that clearly doesn't represent her today, I would say that was cancel culture. That's not what we're doing. We're looking at her recent statements on a crazy subject.
And I think that's key as a difference, because oftentimes, like, I'll criticize people for something and they'll say, you're engaging in cancel culture. And I'll say, well, no, because this is still their view, or they haven't repudiated this view. It's like, if you've moved on, I'm not going to beat a dead horse. If Joy Reid had apologized, said, yes, I was homophobic, I authored those blog posts, I regret it, and I'm sorry, I'd say, okay, move on, go back to your stupid show. Because she lied and gaslit about it, I think it is fair to criticize her for it. In the same way that, like, someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, it's not cancel culture because those are still her views, right? If she had, like you said, blogged at 16 about 9/11 trutherism or something idiotic, I think, okay, well, apologize for it, come clean, say that's not me, and move on from it. But a lot of times, there's this deflection of people who are being criticized for the views they currently hold or at least haven't repudiated, and they say, stop canceling me.
Right. And we're talking about all the famous cases, by the way. So there are so many more, even extraordinarily additionally sympathetic cases that get heard about less because they don't involve famous people. So this phenomenon happens to people who are not well known, and those people are far less prepared to weather the storm. Just, you know, the truck driver who is photographed, you know, making the okay hand sign, not knowing that it has been reappropriated by a small number of like white supremacist type people. Most, I would wager to guess that 90% of people don't know that you're not supposed to use the okay sign anymore because it's become associated with the alt-right. And he gets there's a photo of him taken and he loses his job and he can't get a new job. And, you know, there are people harassing him on social media saying he's a white supremacist. That kind of thing happens to people a lot. And I think those are really sympathetic cases where a person who just is not at all steeped in the increasingly, you know, Byzantine and hard to follow norms of like woke social media activist type people who have just decided on these things 5 seconds ago or what pronouns you're supposed to use, Latinx, like, that's what you're supposed to use. So if someone doesn't use that, are they racist against Hispanic people? But of course, most Hispanic people themselves don't actually like that terminology, that kind of thing. I wrote about once a museum curator, I think it was a museum in San Francisco, and he was doing like a diversity workshop or a meeting about diversity. And he like joked at the end of the meeting, of course, we'll still, you know, so he was trying to diversify the art collection. And he jokes at the end, of course, we'll still take art from some white people. Ha ha ha. And they made him resign over that. And wow. They tarred him in their letter, in their public statement, the employees, saying this man is a white supremacist for what he said. It's so ridiculous. There are so many absurd examples like that. And that's the thing I'm really, really worked up about.
Yeah, it seems like there are, I read about this in The Atlantic, actually, just like random people getting fired for like a 5-minute hate session that happens on Twitter where they get pounced upon. And I almost think that's categorically different and much, much worse than the whole public figure drama, because at the very least, I don't think it's right. For example, the Teen Vogue editor but when you're a journalist or you're a politician or you're a media personality, you do kind of sign up for super heightened scrutiny. Not that that necessarily means it's fair, but it's kind of part of the deal. I have the most sympathy for just random people who get picked out and fired by some angry mob. So maybe you could just talk about a few more examples of that.
Yeah, it's really horrible because it's never proportionate. Like, social media is incapable of following like exactly or giving people exactly what they deserve. So this is one of the least sympathetic cases. Actually, I'll give you one of these. That Central Park dog walking incident lady, Yeah, and she was absolutely in the wrong. She had this altercation with a black man. They actually both had the same last name. I think it was Cooper. And she was in the wrong, and she threatened to call the police on him, even though she had her dog off the leash. And so she got dragged on social media. And you know what? It was deserved, because you should not call the police, like, falsely. And she was sort of in a menacing way to this guy. But you know what? Millions of harassing comments later, she's been fired from her job. She might never be able to get a job again. even in that case, I'm like, okay, has this lady like suffered enough? Do you know what I mean? There comes a point where you're being raked over the coals, like for the 11th hour, and you're public, you've been hung, drawn, and quartered, where it just seems like, man, that's enough. And importantly, the guy that she had, her victim in this, he didn't want to cooperate with the police in like prosecuting her for making a false accusation. He thought she was contrite and it should be over, which I thought was really big of him. I wrote, and this is it's an incident I use in my book, my forthcoming book, which is not out yet. But this woman who had a consulting business, a small business, and she had she was trying to hire a social media coordinator, and she had an applicant, and this woman had what she thought was inappropriate photos on her Instagram. And so she thought it was unprofessional that this woman had submitted her Instagram as an example of the kind of social media feed she would curate if she was hired by the company. So the employer, the business owner, gently criticized her on her own Instagram page, and it was seen by like 50 people. And then the woman claimed on Twitter that she had been sexually harassed by this woman, and it went absurdly viral. It was covered by, I think it was like the We Rate Dogs account for some reason, like retweeted it or something like that. And anyway, you know, 1,000 news articles later, it was covered on The View. It was covered on this woman lost her business. She had to move out of state. She got death threats. She like on the phone, like it's not just on social media, on the phone. She thinks she has people stalking her. And it's just like, yeah, was that a bad Instagram post she had? Sure. Does she know it was a bad idea? Yeah. Does she deserve to have the rest of her life ruined to the point where she has to flee her house? She's in danger. What?
Yeah, no. But I guess let's discuss one of the common points that I hear that I think at least comes from a place of some degree of truth, which is cancel culture may be bad, but conservatives are making such a mountain out of a molehill about it. And more importantly, the amount of people that suffer under cancel culture is nowhere near as proportionate to the amount of harm done to people every single day by racism, sexism, misogyny, homophobia, et cetera. How do you respond when people make that point?
Well, I don't like to actually even separate these things. So, I mean, cancel culture is a form of harassment, and harassment is wrong. And people being harassed for racist or sexist or homophobic reasons is absolutely wrong. But also being like harassed because you did something sort of wrong, but this is in a totally disproportionate way a long time ago, is also wrong. And sometimes the harassment of the people being canceled can take on racist and sexist overtones. So these aren't even like totally separate things, or like homophobic sort of ways. I think of the guy, the makeup guy. Do you remember that guy getting canceled?
I don't think so. There's too many to remember.
There's too many. James Charles, I think. He was like the cover girl.
Yes.
And he lost like tons and tons of YouTube followers after a former business partner.
Oh, I'm still Team Tati.
Okay, I think we disagree on this. So he got called out for like some bad behavior that might have been like sort of bad, but then it was like this whole that he was like tricking straight men into like being interested. It took on this very predatory, he's a small dude. He wasn't like a menacing, threatening, sexually abusive figure. And it came to like totally define him. Like, this guy is a sexual predator. Yes. When it was like, this guy was maybe once or twice said some things to people that were a little inappropriate. So it's totalizing. That's the other thing about cancel culture. The thing you did wrong comes to define you. It is the thing about you. It is you. Not you made a offensive comment a long time ago. You are offensive. It is you. That was a good example of that.
And I think that's a pretty toxic thing to have in a culture or in a society, because I guess when people feel like there's no redemption, or they feel like this toxic, illiberal cancel culture is out there, it can push them, and I'm not saying this excuses it, but it can push them to overlook actual bigotry or actual bias, or support people who maybe really do say some racist things. It's kind of what I would say the Trump phenomenon is, right? They called every Republican under the sun a racist for so many years that a dude who actually says racist stuff came along, and a lot of Republicans were like, eh.
Well, and this is the fastest way to red pill someone, is to subject them to this kind of cancel culture. Because, I've seen this in, I think, some of the incidents I've written about, where then the person becomes a Trump supporter and they're inclined to agree that every time someone is accused of racism or sexism, that the same thing that happened to them is happening to this person. So you create like a coalition of people who are like totally against these issues being discussed at all because they've been wielded in bad faith in the past, which is not healthy at all.
Yeah. So I want to shift gears slightly and ask you about something that I told you I was going to drop on you and not give you a heads up about, because I'm curious what your position is. I don't know if we have the same position. I've been mixed feelings for a long time about the idea of canceling the cancelers. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a lot of times you'll have a woke journalist that goes and digs up somebody's tweets and gets that person canceled or fired in some way. And then people go do it to that journalist, and that journalist loses their job or something like that. And at first, I guess my initial instinct is no, I'm principled. I have one standard that I believe is fair. I should apply that to everyone. But at some point, it's like, is anything going to change if they don't have to play by their own rules? Like, I don't think Joy Reid should have to be fired for her tweets, but under their standard, she should have to be fired for her blog posts, rather, not tweets. And isn't it okay to hold people to their own standards?
Yeah, this is the new rules argument that I hear with some frequency. I don't like this argument because no one making it has actually laid out the social change case for why this will. Well, if we hold more people to these rules, then we'll abolish them. And it seems like there's missing a step two in that, because then I think just what will happen is more people are held to these rules. And that's not really what I want to happen. The retaliatory canceling of the person who brings up the old tweets is more justified than just the, because some conservatives will just try to cancel anyone vaguely on the left. I think of James Gunn. He was the director of, I think, the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, and Mike Cernovich type people found his old offensive tweets and was like,
but isn't that a little different? He was like saying like pedophilic things.
He was saying very bad things that I think were clearly intended as jokes from like a comedic type person in a different era of the internet. So I don't like, I didn't take them as in like actual endorsements of pedophilia at all. And I think anyone who seriously did was misrepresenting it.
I don't know. Maybe I just remember reading them and being like, ew, what on earth, what kind of person would post this? This actually brings to mind the example of Will Wilkinson. Sometimes these people, he tweeted, and you tell us exactly what he tweeted. Will Wilkinson is a New York Times contributing opinion writer, formerly of the Niskanen Center, who was fired because he tweeted about, what exactly was it?
It was something like, if Biden really wants to do unity, he should lynch Mike Pence. The joke being that it was the far right calling for, hang Mike Pence during like the Capitol riots. So it was not a good joke. It was just not a good joke, like even structurally, because he said lynch instead of hang, and hang was what the Capitol riot people. So it wasn't so clear. And also it just didn't land well. Will still thinks it's hilarious. We had a discussion about this with the New York Times.
I just have so much less sympathy for these cases where they're not just saying something offensive or rude, but they're like something illegal. Like he's basically stating that violence should happen and hoping that the implied joke comes through.
No, I disagree with that. I think it's clear it's not actually a call to violence. I mean, it's clear it's not like illegal speech. It's not constitutionally unprotected speech. It's not.
But that's different from like societally unacceptable violent speech.
Yeah, I don't think it was societally unacceptable violent speech. I think it was clearly a bad joke that really didn't land, and people getting all worked up about it were doing so in bad faith. Now, of course, Will is a sort of person who has gotten worked up about things in bad faith in the past.
So and he says cancel culture isn't real. He used to say that. So maybe he deserves the fate, no?
Right.
I mean, and how am I supposed to feel bad?
Maybe you don't feel bad. I felt a little bad for him because I tend to feel bad for victims of these things, even if they're people I've feuded with in the past, even if they're people who I think have really misrepresented my work. That's just kind of how I feel about things. I feel for the person being dragged to the scaffolds, you know, even if it's like Maria Antoinette or something, it just seems wrong to me. So that's broadly why I don't like the retaliatory canceling, but also probably more importantly, I just don't see how that gets us somewhere we want to get. I'll hear people say, yeah, we have to hold them to their new rules. And then what? Like, what's the next thing to, then the rules will be repealed because the rules are not formal, right? There's not a lawmaking body that will then rescind them after they've been held to them. So it just doesn't seem to me like it's going to work.
Yeah, no, that's a valid point. I think if anything, it's just a sense of injustice. They're just like, well, we should hold them to it because that's justice. I don't really think there's any logical way that holding them to it will make this thing end. But I guess then how do we make it end, right? How do we move beyond kind of this cancel culture? I mean, obviously, we're not going to support any sort of like government intervention into here. When we start talking about societal solutions, it can quickly become like very boilerplate or hand wavy, like, oh, well, we just all need to come together and think about and learn to respect each other or to have grace or like wishy wavy. But like, how tangibly actually do we address this problem?
I mean, we need to come together and have grace. It's frustrating because it is difficult to grapple with a nebulous cultural phenomena, let alone solve or change it. So there is no solution. There's certainly no government solution. I don't even think, we're talking about constitutionally protected speech for the most part. I don't even think like, so social media is a problem on this front, like because it facilitates this, but I don't like when people reflexively blame big tech for things. And there's so many positives to social media. Like, I don't even think we should restrict social media because of this. Because it's us. It's people doing this. No one made you do this. You did this. It's you. So we do, I mean, it's frustrating, but we do need to enshrine some broad cultural norm of forgiveness. Maybe that will happen when more people are held accountable. Maybe people will just eventually stop caring because this will be so common. It will hit everyone. Maybe when everyone's embarrassing photo or text from when they were 16 has leaked, will be rapidly approaching the timeline where that happens. Then maybe people will stop caring. For my part as a journalist, that's one thing, like media ethics. We can advocate for journalists to practice different media ethics, and you can criticize journalists when they don't follow them. So I have become much more careful about naming people in stories where the person might be harassed for having, you know, done something wrong, even if they're the villain of the story, you know, the student who calls someone racist or gets someone in trouble. Like, I am now reticent to use their name, even if I think they would deserve some amount of shame or accountability from what they did, because what they're going to get is vastly disproportionate shaming. And I'm aware of that now, so I'm careful. Now, if it's the student government president and they put out a public statement, probably I'm still going to name them. But if it's just some student who is writing ridiculous comments on Instagram, probably I'm not going to name them. So that's a kind of thing media figures need to consider. Does this person need to be named? And I understand why broadly journalists have had in the past this presumption toward naming sources and naming figures, although that kind of went out the door during the Trump administration when everyone is an anonymous source, which has really annoyed me. Now I think it needs to tilt the other way a little bit because of the power of negative news stories to just decimate a person's life out of proportion to what they deserve.
Yeah, absolutely. But one thing you touched on just a minute ago that I want to backtrack on is that I think very, very soon, everybody is going to have a digital record from their youth, right? I have it from like when I was 12 or 13, but like kids these days are getting an iPad at age 2. And I like to play the game where I think of, if everyone who was in their 60s right now had a track record digitally preserved of everything they said when they were in their 20s and teens, they'd all be canceled so freaking fast.
People who are in their 60s today might not have supported interracial marriage when they were younger.
Right. They might have. Yeah, yikes. Oh, wow. They might have. There's people who oppose like desegregation.
Right. Right.
So I guess my point is that pretty soon we're going to reach a point where everybody has a history. And I think at some point it will just become a lot less impactful or effective, or people will just become numb to it. But I hope we don't have to see people's lives ruined until we get to that point.
I mean, we could also, some of our complaint culture is a little embedded in the structures of government and government rules about human resources in companies and things like that. There's a lot of stuff propping up, you should file a claim, you should, you know, giving workers like more power, too much power. This is kind of a libertarian complaint. There's a vast empowering of like, based on Title IX and Title VI, of people who are offended for any reason in the educational environment or the workplace environment. Those are structures, and those could be taken down a peg, and I would support doing that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave the serious talk. If people are interested in learning more about this stuff, they can check out the link to Robbie's book, which traces a lot of the source of this ideology to college campuses and the activists that populate it. The link to that is in the episode description. Robbie, now for the most important part of the show, the most crucial that everyone comes for, hit us with your hot food take.
This is amazing. I truly think I might be a person known for having really bad food takes if you didn't exist with your even more ridiculous food takes. I don't really like spicy food or interesting food. Like, I mostly just eat plain foods. I actually eat the same thing for lunch pretty much every day. I eat 2 eggs over easy on top of cheddar cheese wrapped up in a tortilla shell.
That's bizarre.
That's what I have for lunch
every day. Very plain.
Yes. I love the lack of flavor.
Okay. Well, you enjoy that, I guess. Everybody, Robbie Swab, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.